Okay, we know a lot more. Glenn, go right ahead.
Yeah, I'm kind of familiar with building, you know, DC load banks with resistors like this. Ohmite makes similar dimensions, like around 6 inches in length, about 1.5 inches wide, and typically those are the sizing for the 250 to 300 watt resistor range, depending on the type of, and they're usually typically wire wound devices. For HF, they're probably pretty good for dummy loads. In this particular case, that's the maximum peak power rating for these devices. I would say that in the still air with just, you know, convection around the outside of these, figure each one of these resistors would probably dissipate about 100 watts a piece, pretty close to CW. So you probably have something there without a fan close to a 300 watt demi load. And if you probably put a fan on it, you could probably pull some peak power as high as 750 watts, but you'd have to keep your eye on it. KC2 QIQ.
Now, in the old days, what an awful lot of amateurs did, crafty amateurs, is they needed a 300 watt, a 500 watt, a 1000 watt dummy load. And these guys were, you know, running the ham radio operation on a paper route where they get $5 per week, so they can't buy expensive stuff. You'd be amazed how many people have used 30 watt, 60 watt, 100 watt light bulbs as dummy loads. You take a bunch of 100 watt light bulbs, put them in series parallel combinations. When you get the combination right, at the power level you're running, the light bulbs come up to some reasonable amount of illumination intensity, and 1,000 watt light bulbs will easily dissipate a kilowatt of power, key down forever. But there's a catch, and that is the resistance of that 100 watt light bulb changes by more than a 10 to 1 ratio when it's cold versus hot. A 100 watt light bulb should be something in the vicinity of 120 ohms of resistance, 130 ohms or so of resistance, when it's hot, and it'll draw roughly 1 ampere on a 120 volt line. But when it's cold, that 125 ohms is going to be something like 10 ohms. So you got to go through a little bit of a mysterious startup region there until the filament gets hot. But with the right combination of series, parallel, and maybe a couple of capacitors and inductors in the right place, you can make a damn close to 50 ohm dummy load for a few thousand watts rather easily out of 100 watt light bulbs. That's another possible solution when you need dummy loads. I don't know who wants to get it. Give me your call letters, K2RAW on the tech pad.
I'm just wondering what will be the reactance of a light bulb set up like that at 14 megahertz. It sounds almost reasonable, but I don't think it will come close to 50 ohms at the frequency. I should try that one, Dick.
I'll bet you at 14 megacycles, a light bulb is not bad. And the little bit of series inductance it has, you're smart enough to put a shunt capacitor in the right place and make that reactance go away. On top of that, particularly if you've got an antenna tuner, you can take the reactance of your light bulb circuit, even before you correct it, just readjust your antenna tuner, your transmitter will see 50 ohms exactly, it'll be happy. The light bulbs are dissipating the energy, they're happy. So there's a very inexpensive solution here with 100 watt light bulbs, an antenna tuner, and whatever frequency you want to test with your transmitter. Now if you want to do this at the kilowatt level at 432 megacycles, you got a problem. Very few of us have an antenna tuner at 432 megacycles, and the light bulbs at 432 are going to be highly reactive. You're going to have to work a lot harder to make those light bulbs a resistive load instead of a reactive load when you get up to that higher frequency. But still, there's a possible solution there. Anybody have any further comments? Give me a call. It's K2RAW.
Just wondering why we don't see dummy loads like that for the HF. It seems simple enough.
They used to use a light bulb all the time.
It was a popular dummy load in the old, old days. And the guys with that knowledge have all died off or become quiet. And the new people say, gee, I'll write a check and I'll use my credit card and I'll make the problem go away. You go scanning the internet and you find five different brands of dummy load and you choose one. And the fact that you've got a beautiful dummy load sitting, well, the incandescent light bulbs are slowly disappearing. You can't easily do this when it comes to the cold cathode fluorescent tubes we're now using, or the hot cathode, the fluorescent tubes, the low, high-efficiency things, you can't do that. So incandescent light bulbs are slowly disappearing, and we're losing them. We're losing some of our better dummy loads. Anybody have any further comments?
KC2, QIQ.
Jefferson, 5 watts.
Okay.
I use a light bulb as a dummy load, and I'm not dead yet, and I'm sure not quiet, so be careful what you say, Dick.
Yeah, these old guys, though, you gotta... Okay. Let's see. Glenn, go ahead.
Actually, one of my favorite dummy loads all around. If you ever at a ham fest or you see these things come up for sale, grab them. I know everybody loves Bird watt meters, but let me tell you something. Bird makes one heck of a load, and they make 500-watt continuous all-day-long loads, and then you get the 1.5 kilowatt versions. These things are very, very hard to find, but the 500-watters are easy to find, and pretty much when you're just tuning up your transmitter, the 500-watter could be used on a 1.5 kW linear amp just to tune it up real quick. And they're beautiful, and you can find them usually well under $200, and a lot of times less than that. But if you can find one of these Berg loads, these things are fantastic. KC2QIQ.
I own one of those. Boy, do I have a story. But let's pick up Howie first. Howie, you had a comment?
Yeah, how about a number 47 you used to use on 2 meters or 6 meters, even on 10 meters, a 5-watt load. A little number 47 lamp.
Amory FWR indicator.
Beautiful solution there. Andy and Mel, Howard and Mel. Yep. Now, the nice thing about the number 47 panel light bulb is that it's so darn small, it doesn't have enough physical length to it to make very much reactive, so it's a damn close to a resistive load. So choose the right light bulb for your particular frequency range and your particular power level, and you've got a lot more dummy loads in the house than you know about. Now, when it comes to the 500-watt Bird dummy load, I own one of those. Beautiful device. Good, probably up to 1,000 megacycles. And recently, I used it for an extremely elaborate experiment. I was measuring very, very low intermodulation distortion. And I could measure the intermodulation distortion, 100 and some odd dB down, from a dummy load when I'm putting 1,000 watts of power into it. So I'm watching the intermodulation distortion, it's called passive intermodulation distortion, coming out of my Bird 500-watt dummy load, while I'm putting 500 watts into it, by the way. I got the numbers a little bit wrong here. And I watch it crawl as it heats up through a particular, what's what I'm going to call it now, intermod level versus time. I watched it crawl through a particular, let's call it signature. I would then turn it off, let it cool off a little bit, and watch it go through the exact same signature every time. In other words, as the resistors heated up inside, as the connector itself, a steel connector, heated up, it made passive intermodulation distortion at a particular rate versus temperature versus time, and it was interesting how characteristic that was. Then you take a small hammer, so to speak, and hammer on the dummy load and watch those numbers change. So when you're measuring very, very low intermodulation distortion, you'd be amazed how much measurements you can make of this thing. I'm going to call it a black box, but it had a whole lot of fins on it. It was made by Bird. Anybody have any further comments? Give me your call. It's K2RAW.
Yeah, K2KEY.
Very good, guys. Mel first, and then Eric. Go ahead, Mel.
Now, if you want to call us old-timers especially, maybe you want to call me an old-timer. When I was 13 years old, I had a budget of $15 to get on the air to put a ham station together. No support any other than a few dollars, like I say, the $15 I saved up. And in the ARRL used to send out these little, those days for nothing, how to become an amateur radio, getting on the air and all. All these things were popular. 47, putting 47s on 300 ohm, which was a popular, my feed line, was not even new 300 ohm television twin lead. It was second-hand stuff that was cut down, going to be thrown away. And you put 247 lamps on it, that was my power and my SWR indicator. And light bulbs and all that stuff, thick, it was commonplace. I don't know why everybody's so surprised over it.
There's a reason why they don't use light bulbs anymore. Very specific, can I say?
Sure can, say it.
In the days of vacuum tube finals, they had Pi network outputs that were broadly tuned, where you'd dip and load the final. Those basically had antenna tuners in them and could handle the wide impedance variations. The solid state rigs don't have that. And before you figure out how to tune it to the the light bulb, you've already overheated your final and gone into shutdown or something.
But the modern day guy has an antenna tuner, which gives some of that function back. But you brought up a good point. Now, when it comes to high power dummy loads, Eric has from time to time dumped 50,000 watts from a broadcast transmitter into a dummy load and watched it heat up. And it probably is oil cooled, if I know him. And if he measures the intermodulation distortion, or if he measures the standing wave ratio of his dummy load as it heats up, I'll bet you he has seen some variations. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, KE2EJ. Well, the last gentleman covered one particular area I was going to speak, and that is when I was 13, I had a TX60 crystal controlled novice transmitter. It had a 6146 in the final and a tank, and 100 watt light bulb was a good way to practice CW. Most people don't realize how versatile a 100 watt light bulb can be. Not only in terms of dumping RF into it, but if you're into fixing solid state devices, or if you're into fixing switching supplies, where you know you've got something shorted or something bad. If you take a 100 watt light bulb and put it in series with the device that you're working on and plug that into the wall, you can save yourself an awful lot of grief, because when everything's working right, the light bulb will light up a little bit, and when something's shorted, the light bulb lights up brightly and you don't get let the smoke out of the other parts that can keep their smoke in. And I have been known to boil water. Actually, using that 60 kilowatt dummy load, there's, if you've noticed, or the next time you go over and look, there's a thermometer. So we actually have a calorimetric formula over a period of time for it to raise the water temperature by 1 degree, and we convert that directly into watts. And by the way, that's how the FCC likes to hear about it. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Now, I did exactly that experiment on my new microwave oven. It's got 10 different power levels. So far, I've only tested the high power level, put an 8-ounce glass of water in there with a thermometer, a microwave thermometer, and ran it for exactly 1 minute or 2 minutes and measured the amount of temperature rise, and therefore figure out how many watts the microwave oven is really delivering to my water. And I intend to repeat the experiment at each of the lower levels. Our new microwave oven is so much healthier than the old one that all of the old timing that my wife used to remember, you know, she cooks her coffee this amount of time. Everything overheats these days because the darn thing puts out so many watts. And we have to start using the lower power levels. Okay, Joe signed in. I'll bet you he's got an interesting problem. Although, hey, Joe, we're going to challenge you. Do you have a problem anywhere near as fascinating as these guys from Yonkers? W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
No, not at all. I just have a question on DTV. One question on DTV and one question on something I send you in an email, which has to do with a compound you use for sealing connectors. Which one do you want first?
Yeah, I saw that thing on the stuff sealing of connectors, and the fact that it's got certain resonant frequencies. That sort of amazed me. I'd like to know a little bit more about what's going on there. When it comes to digital TV, the last four TechNets in a row, for 3 solid hours, we've been discussing digital television. When you guys get your February issue 2009 of QST Magazine, The World Above 50 Megacycles by W3ZZ, Gene Zimmerman, I know him pretty well, met him at quite a few of the VHF conferences. He's got a rather nice article here about digital television and the impact it's going to have on 6-meter ham radio. And lots of accuracy there with one error, and that is, he specifically states that digital television requires more power out of the digital television transmitter in order to get the same range as analog. I'm reasonably sure he's wrong on that one. And once again, when we get a chance, I'm going to have Eric tell us how many decibels of advantage digital has over analog. I think it's something like 9 decibels or so of advantage. Therefore, a kilowatt transmitter on digital television can go a long way. But first, go ahead with any of the questions you want to discuss, Joe. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Who said that, Dick?
Who said that? First of all, the question is so brief and a little bit ambiguous. Give me a couple more words.
No, somebody said that it takes more power. Who said that?
Mr. Gene Zimmerman, Whiskey 3 Zulu Zulu, the guy who is the column editor for World Above 50 Megacycles, QST Magazine, February issue, 2009, the latest issue. He specifically states, he's got lots of good data in there. He goes on for a couple of pages of digital television. He's right on target on what we've been interested in for the last 4 weeks. But he does say that digital television requires more power to get the same range. I know he's wrong on that one. As long as we got you here, Eric, what's the rough number of decibels of advantage? I know there's a lot of variables in here depending on how much multipath, but if multipath is not bad, how many decibels of advantage in a laboratory, let's say, does digital television have over analog? Analog television requires something like 45 decibels of carrier-to-noise ratio, peak carrier-to-noise ratio, to get a broadcast-quality picture. And I think digital television doesn't require anything like that. I think it's more like 17 decibels of carrier-to-noise ratio. I know that's the wrong term for the Bart set, but there's lots of decibels of advantage there. Give us a couple more words to clear that one up there, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. If you remember, last week or the week before, we covered the specifics of the digital form of carrier-to-noise ratio or signal-to-noise ratio, which is not the same as an analog, but let's just for the sake of it, consider them to be close to one another. That's noise-free television picture and analog starts at around 45 dB signal on carrier-to-noise ratio. A picture that you can see in digital television, because either you see it or you don't, starts at 27 dB, so you can calculate what the difference is between that. But let me give you a better example. I cover my grade B area, and to make my grade B area, I operate on, now I'm talking UHF, we're talking VHF, the numbers get a heck of a lot lower. Let's talk VHF, what the heck. On Empire, there's an antenna with, essentially it's 3 dB of gain. And we operate with, say, 24 kilowatts to reach, let's call it, Lake Hopatcong, New Jersey, which is kind of the edge of the grade B. I'm going to drop. And now, to provide the same type of service, covering the same signal area, actually, when we did that overnight measurement, when we did actually operate on channel 13, the results were absolutely incredible, but we cover the same grade B area with 2.7 kilowatts. So that's the difference between 2.7 kilowatts and 24 kilowatts. K2RIW, K2EJ.
That's 9 or so decibels of superiority. Now, 24 kilowatts into a 3 dB gain antenna, and I know your bat wing up there for channel 13 has got a lot more than 3 dB of gain, but by the time you go through the feed line loss, the power divider, the multiplexer and whatever, from the transmitter output to the radiated signal, I think you're saying you got 3 dB over isotropic. Therefore, your 24 kilowatts becomes very close to 50 kilowatts of effective isotropic radiated power. Guess on my part. But 24 kilowatts of real power out of the transmitter for analog versus 2.7 kilowatts out of the digital transmitter gave you essentially the same, I guess you would call it grade B coverage. I think that's what you're saying. Eric, is that true? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, by the way, the transmitter that transmits analog and the transmitter that transmits digital there on channel 13 is the same transmitter. So the only thing that's different is the exciter.
Now, you cut that 24 kilowatt transmitter. That's 24 kilowatts of peak envelope power, sync peak maximum, I'm guessing, whereas 27 kilowatts of RMS power out of your digital television, I'm guessing, is that mean that you decreased the drive? Or are we talking about a difference of measurement technique of peak envelope power of sync tip pulse in one case versus the what looks like a Barthead spread spectrum pseudo-random noise modulated thing? Was there a lower amount of true RMS drive power for the digital versus the analog into that exact same transmitter? Over to you, Eric.
We have to look at it from a different perspective here. The actual legal TPL, by the way, the antenna is 3 dB of gain, really. If we use both phase, which we're not going to do, it's 7 dB of gain. If they use both phase, then it's down to 1.2 kilowatts out of the transmitter. It really doesn't like to put that little out, but let's get past the point of talking about where the energy is and how it's spread across. So what you're calling drive and the actual operating power level, if I was going to run the equivalent power level, not the licensed power level, what the transmitter is capable of doing, then I would be giving it more drive, or I wouldn't be reducing the drive quite nearly as much, so it's not a fair question.
Yeah, the comparison between the two in watts is a difficult one. I see that coming. Very similar to, you talk to a cellular telephone engineer who operates on base stations, and you ask him what's the average power coming out of the transmitter for one particular client. Boy, you get a complicated answer. Or what's the total power coming out of the transmitter at any instant of time, depending on the number of clients. Again, you get a complicated answer. You can talk about it statistically, to talk about the crest factor and the peak envelope power, maximum, whatever, it gets complicated. But poor Joe here, Joe just gave us a hint that he's going to ask about digital television, and here we're going off into Neverland. Give us whichever question you like, Joe. You got the floor. I think you're the last guy with a real question here tonight. To me, 2RYY, K2RYW.
I got a real question for when he's finished.
Well, you're on the list. Joe, you got it.
Okay. If I look at a digital television carrier on the air, I can see something that looks like a pilot carrier at about 310 kilohertz above the bottom end of the specific RF channel segment that you're on, your 6 megahertz channel. Comparing that level carrier to the average noise or what the transmitter power you see spread across the rest of the 6 megahertz bandwidth of that channel, what is the ratio between that peak signal that you read on that carrier to the average noise? Is there any specific ratio that you're set to?
Don, good question. Eric, is that pilot signal at 309.... kilohertz, roughly 310 kilohertz above the low end of the channel on digital television transmission, is there an exact ratio of that pilot tone amplitude measured with, let's say, a 1 kilohertz resolution bandwidth spectrum analyzer? Is there an exact relationship between that carrier power, I'm just restating what I think Joe asked, versus the real true RMS power coming out of the transmitter? Does everybody set that pilot tone at the exact same ratio of amplitude? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. I don't have the actual values in front of me, but I remember a 0.606 of something, and I don't remember exactly what it is. I can look at it for you. There's an absolute value, and there's, in essence, you can't set the level of that. It's mathematically derived as the signal is constructed. It relates to, this actually has several different purposes, but it is a point of training. It actually has modulation on it that's time sensitive, let's call it, or it helps the equalizer number one. It also helps the demodulator determine where I and Q is, and it also represents a certain value over DC because it's a constant signal. And there is an absolute value, and it's the same in all the exciters. It's not something that you can control, and it has a very precise specification.
Okay, now I'm going to form the next question, which use the information you just gave me. If at my house I measure channel 21 and I measure with a 1KC resolution bandwidth on the spectrum analyzer, I measure 0 dBm on channel 21 for when they're on digital television for that pilot zone. And then I go over to channel 22 and at my house I measure minus 10 dBm instead of 0 dBm. I measure 10 decibels of difference in a 1 kilohertz noise resolution bandwidth, IF bandwidth, call it what you like, of the spectrum analyzer. I measure 10 decibels of difference of those carriers. Can I fairly safely say within the nearest fraction of a decibel that in my house one signal is 10 dB louder than the other signal, total power across the whole bar set? KE2EJ, KE2RIW.
KE2RIW, KE2EJ.
Are we talking about measuring channel 21 as it is now and then measuring channel 22?
Negatory. Assume this is now February 30th, a phony date, where everybody's on digital television. And I'm comparing channel 21 versus channel 22, digital television, both channels, and I'm measuring the pilot tone in a narrow band spectrum analyzer, and I see 10 dB of difference in pilot tones. Does that mean that at my house, those signal strengths are really 10 dB different if I integrated across the whole 6 megs of bandwidth of channel 21 and I had a super filter to do that with, you know, a brick wall filter, and I moved my brick wall filter to channel 22 and I measured total power, would I again get 10 decibels of difference? Over to you, Eric.
All right, well, let's assume now that you're actually doing this by measuring just a little part of that waveform. You're doing a sample and hold just for the period that the pilot is there. There, if you're going to make a comparison between channel 21 and channel 22, just based on where the pilot is, because there's a section of it that has no modulation that's actually CW, yes, that's a very real 10 dB of difference. But don't apply that rule to the rest of it.
Okay. What's the maximum resolution bandwidth I could have on my spectrum analyzer when I'm measuring that pilot tone so that I get a good reading of the average power or peak power, whichever I'm looking for? I think because there's really a modulation on that pilot tone, I got to be careful. If I use a narrow enough bandwidth on the resolution bandwidth of the spectrum analyzer, I'd like to believe channel 21 always has the exact same amount of power of that pilot tone, assuming they're always intending to put out the same transmitter power. So you know what the modulation is like on that pilot tone. How narrow do I have to set the spectrum analyzer so I really measure just the 309 point blank 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 kilohertz component, called it the F0 component, so to speak? How narrow do I have to be to make sure I'm really measuring just that? Over to you, Eric.
All right, well, if you're talking about a conventional spectrum analyzer, here's your problem. You really want to know where those fast rise and fall times are. If you start to reduce the bandwidth, you know, it's like stuffing everything through a big capacitor, and you start integrating the whole thing, and it now becomes difficult to say, you know, where is the energy that I'm interested in, and where is the energy that I'm not interested in. But if you just want to take an average and, you know, deal with the noise that's going to get added in on both sides of you, you know, you can turn it down to, you know, 1 kilohertz worth of bandwidth and, you know, take the peak and use that as your point of measurement. But if you want to be accurate about it, you better see where the edges of the stuff are.
Okay, I hear what you said. But now if I go back to some of the Gary information, Mr. Scrignoli, got some nice pictures out of a spectrum analyzer of what a digital television transmission looks like if you use a relatively broad, let's say 100kc wide resolution bandwidth. The pilot tone is absolutely not there. But as you start going down to very narrow resolution bandwidths on the spectrum analyzer, all of a sudden the pilot tone starts standing out very distinctly. I had the impression from the Scrignoli information that if I use a narrow enough bandwidth, not only is the pilot tone very easily to resolve compared to the rest of the Bartet of total transmission spectrum, believe if I set my spectrum analyzer on it in the zero scan bandwidth, zero scan mode, set on that pilot tone with a 1KC resolution bandwidth, I have the impression I'm going to see what looks like a CW key down signal with no modulation. That's what I thought Squignoli was telling me. Over to you, Eric.
That's what you'll see. But you didn't say, you kept saying peak, okay? If you're talking about average, that's absolutely the way to go. If in the wider bandwidth, you see the bump, but you don't really see the pilot. It's when you finally get down and get rid of all the noise that you can see that constant level of DC, really. That single frequency carrier is actually there. But don't forget, it's going to be, when you reduce the bandwidth that much, you're going to be doing a certain amount of averaging.
Okay, now I'm going to go to the next step. I've put that pilot tone in the middle of my screen on a real good spectrum analyzer. I've set the spectrum analyzer in the zero scan mode. He's now a A-scope. And while I'm in the A-scope mode, sitting on exactly that 309 blank, blank, blank kilohertz signal, and I start changing the res bandwidth of the spectrum analyzer, I'm starting to make it more and more broad. Eventually, I'm going to start seeing modulation in that zero scan mode. My horizontal line is going to start developing squiggles. Give me a rough guess. What res bandwidth will I start seeing modulation on that pilot tone in the zero scan mode? Over to you, Eric.
Modulation you're not going to see. You're going to see noise on both sides of you. The noise is going to start coming in at, 10 kilohertz? I think the next step after that is 100 kilohertz. That's all you see.
Okay, so like if I keep it below 10 kilohertz, I can now make a rather specific measurement of power output of what looks like a CW signal when I'm in the zero scan mode of that pilot tone. Could I use that as a method of referencing what is the approximate power output of that digital television transmitter? If I use the right conversion factor, can I convert that pilot tone into a estimate of transmitter power output? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, I see why not. That should be simple enough to do.
Okay. I think, after a whole bunch of changes here, that's sort of the question that Joe was asking. Maybe not. Back to you, Joe. You got the floor.
That is the question exactly that I was asking. The relationship between the carrier that you see in the air on that frequency and the average noise distributed over the rest of the channel. And if you give me a moment, I'll put my analyzer back on the air and I'll look and see what it is. I had a specific reason for asking. Just give me about 1 minute. I'll be right back to you.
Okay. Now, Eric, I do remember you saying 17 decibels of carrier-to-noise ratio, digital television, possible reception. Maybe I've got a lousy memory. Today you told us it's 27 decibels of carrier-to-noise ratio required for the digital converter to lock up. Now, snow-free, broadcast quality, analog television, something like 45, I think it is, decibels of carrier-to-noise ratio, peak envelope carrier-to-noise ratio required. So I think you're telling me by some method of assessment, the simplistic carrier-to-noise ratio for the, what am I looking for now? Constellation. For the constellation diagram test set to give me accurate enough landings of those dots of the 8 BSB signal so that my digital demodulator is reasonably happy in a relatively low multipath environment, that something in the vicinity of 27 decibels of carrier-to-noise ratio is required to get a guaranteed lockup. I think that's what you just said to us a few transmissions ago, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, K2RIW, K2EJ. Let's straighten out a couple of things. The reference is 27 dB, all right? Now, what happens at 27 dB is really magic, and that's where no error correction is involved, no fixing of the incoming signal. That's the equivalent of the snow-free picture. Depending upon the receiver, you can go down one heck of a lot lower, still have it locked up. And I mean one heck of a lot lower, whereas the newer receivers are getting better and better and better. Actually, once you start getting below 23, 22, most receivers really have a difficult time. So 27 is the magic number. Typically, a station that is well tuned up at the transmitter and putting out a good signal with relatively low multipath will give you a 36 dB noise figure in the end. Remember, 27 is what ATSC says you got to have for it to work right. And that's really 27 is what you got when the receiver is loafing and it isn't working right.
Okay, 27, and I think you're saying then that a favorable environment in multipath, where I'm going to start getting some bit errors, the 27 dB on, let's say, a fifth generation demodulator box probably can go down to 22 or 23 dB of carrier to noise ratio and still give me picture on the screen 98% of the time. Is that approximately right?
Yeah, it's approximately right. And actually, the fifth, and as we get to the seventh generation boxes, remember, either you get the picture and it looks perfect, or maybe for a 1 dB area of chatter, you get a little pixelation or blockages or boxing, and then another tenth of a dB below that, it just goes to black.
Yeah, that's the so-called cliff effect that we're all about to learn about. And I'm hearing television DXing people hearing 800-mile signals under favorable conditions. You got a few guys out there from the Worldwide Television FM and DX Association that just love doing television DXing, and they started doing it with digital television. And we're hearing reports, which, by the way, were mentioned in this World Above 50 Megacycles by Gene Zimmerman, W3ZZ. He mentions that he has seen 100-some-odd miles, but he's heard reports of guys getting 800 miles and getting at least briefly getting a snow-free picture. A picture on the screen that you can photograph and request the station to give you a QSL card or the equivalent. So digital television DXing is going to take place. There's guys out there just love experimenting with this stuff. I had another question along these lines. I can't remember it right now. That pixelation is going to be kind of fun to watch when you're really at threshold and hopping in and out. And I've had, oh, here's my question. We've heard about third generation, fifth generation, and upcoming is the seventh generation of the demodulator box for digital television. Okay. Is it just coincidental that all the generations just happen to be odd numbers? What happened to the second, the fourth, and the sixth generation? K2EJ, K2LIW.
Mike? Oh, it sounded like somebody was dropping in there. You know, I don't have the answer to that question, but I couldn't find out.
Maybe they were canceled by a push-pull politics.
Yeah, these
cut out by the repeater.
Yeah, whenever anything strange happens, a politician did it. Joe, you got the floor.
No, push-pull cancel second-order harmonics, maybe second-order revisions.
Okay, good guess. Joe, W2RYY, go ahead.
I'm looking at a signal right now for channel 21. We'll take that for example because you like talking about channel 21. Channel 22 digital has a carrier on 518.3325, which is at minus 62, 63, let me see, I'm wrong about 70, 60, minus 54 dBm. That's on my service monitor, and at a 20 kilohertz scan width, 20 kilohertz per division, which is scanning about 1 megahertz across the whole picture. No, less than that. No, let's see, 500 kilohertz across the whole picture, something like that. The average noise I see is a little less than minus 70 dBm, just about touching the minus 70 dBm line, but the pilot carrier is at like minus 54. That's what I'm talking about, because I've tried using this to actually see. I can see carriers out there, that are quite weak, and my digital decoder will not respond to carriers below a certain level. But if they're at, if that pilot carrier seems to be about minus 75 or stronger, then my television decoder can lock up on the picture. Below that, it will not lock up on it. In fact, if it's minus 80, it won't even see it. It won't even recognize the thing is actually being there. That's why I was asking about the particular ratio, because there's only one decoder I've ever seen that actually published the specifications of the sensitivity of the decoder, and that was a Channel Master CM7000, which had a range of, they said, minus 5 dBm to minus 83 dBm. That's why I was asking a specific question about that particular carrier.
Yeah, you keep calling it a carrier, and that's a logical way to call it. I think we're going to have to start learning to call it the pilot tone. And the big variable is not how far you're scanning across the whole screen. What was the res bandwidth? When you measure that pilot tone, you're going to get a different number depending on what the res bandwidth of your your spectrum analyzer was. Hopefully that res bandwidth was in the vicinity of 10 kilohertz to really measure that pilot tone amplitude is the impression I'm getting. Back to you, Joe.
Service monitors, it probably changes that automatically within the unit, so I don't know what the resolution bandwidth, the number you're talking about. That's not, you can't change that. You can only change the analyzer sweep width. That's the only thing you can change. The other stuff, I believe, changes automatically as you change. You go to a narrower sweep scan width, the resolution bandwidth will go lower and lower, because if I do that, as I'm talking to you, I can see the pilot carry doesn't change very much, but if I get down to a sweep width of 2 kilohertz, that pilot carry does not drop down very much, but the noise in each shot of it drops down significantly by another 10 dB or so. I'm down to 2 kilohertz per division, so that'll be 16 across the whole screen. So that's what I'm talking about, because this receiver, these receivers have to respond to a certain level of signal. And I go up to, say, like 1 megahertz. It makes the noise even go up even further, so I know there's a different ratio as far as your instrumentation sees, but I'm talking about just off the air type of stuff. If you're looking at these things, I'm trying to do this for a specific reason, to be able to ultimately determine, once I get the proper antenna up, what kind of level I have coming in as far as strength versus the minimum my decoder wants to see. I'm trying to determine, I guess you'd call it your headroom for decoding the signal, 10 dB, 20 dB, 30 dB, or something like that. Ultimately, that's why I'm asking these kind of questions. I want to, you know, basically get an idea of how well my system is working once I have the thing up with an amplifier and the proper antenna.
Are you looking at a communication service monitor?
He sure is. Probably an IFR. And if he looks at his service as his owner's manual, he'll find out for each individual scan width, the owner's manual is going to tell him what it automatically selects for the resolution bandwidth. If this was a real independent spectrum analyzer, a Hewlett Packard 8566, you have enough knobs on the front panel, so to speak, where you can independently set scan width, scan time, res bandwidth, whatever, video bandwidth, and so on. He doesn't have those knobs on that service monitor. But he can force that. As he centers the pilot tone on the screen of the service monitor in the spectrum analyzer mode, and he sets his scan width low enough, I think he can force it into whatever res bandwidth he wants. Do you see it that way, Eric? K2EJ, K2LIW?
K2RIW, K2EJ, well, you know, communication devices are not scientific measuring instruments. They're designed to do a job, and they give you the facilities to do the job with. And that's what it's for. I had you come last Wednesday when I did my little demonstration and talk. I brought a real spectrum analyzer with me and gave people an idea of what it looked like. So, I guess you got to use the tools you got, you know.
Dick, I've got some numbers from the last week's DTV test, so if you're interested. This is KB2BD. Name is John.
KB2BD. Recognize John. We're going to get to you in a second. Yeah, his service monitor, as far as the spectrum analyzer mode, doesn't have absolute calibration. When he reads minus 80 dBm on that, is it really minus 80 dBm? Well, Joe is smart enough to go and take his signal generator, which he has calibrated with his TrueRMS Hewlett-Packard power meter. And so he calibrates his signal generator with his power meter. He uses the signal generator as a reference signal generator into the service monitor in the spectrum analyzer mode, and he finds out what power level on the screen is really there. So when he says minus 83 dBm, I think he's accurate with the nearest fraction of a dB. My question to you, Eric, is other than the one brand name that Joe has found, have any of the third, fifth, and seventh generation of digital demodulators, has the manufacturer been smart enough to start claiming how many dBm of signal is required to get a demodulation? Is minus 83 dBm a possible number where a good 3.5 dB noise figure front end on a digital demodulator will give me a picture on screen? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2RIW, K2J. I actually have not seen a specification like that from manufacturers of finished products, but I know, and I'm actually about to see somebody turn me on to is a complete tuner, UHF, VHF, ATSC, NTSC, and the output of this tuner produces a parallel stream. It goes for about $20 in quantity of thousands. So you figure you'll probably pay about $30. It's got an F connector on it. And the thing's no bigger than, a USB connector, a USB drive. Say a Bic lighter, it's not much bigger than your pen. Oh, that's a good thing. It's not much bigger than an end barrel. That's a good size. That's about the size of it. And there's actual real numbers, but I haven't seen them yet.
Very nice. We're going to pick up Joe and then John in that order. Joe, go ahead with the rest of your question. Interesting question. So V2LYY, K2LYW.
Yeah, if I change the analyzer setting to a scan range of about 1 megahertz per box, which gives it about a 10 megahertz across the whole screen, I still see the pilot carry approximately minus, actually it goes down a little bit, it goes down like minus 65, because it's not looking at this, well, I'm looking at a different channel now also. But it looks like the noise is about, on average, about 10 dB below that pilot carry. That's why I was asking this kind of question, just to be able to determine if a signal I see on the open analyzer is a copyable signal I would be able to get in one of these decoder boxes. That goes as far as that. If you don't know the ratio, the answer for the ratio on this week, I guess I'll catch it on next week. My other question had to do with the that email I sent you, Dick, but before I ask you if you have any comments on that, back to your microwave oven thing about putting things in there. What is approximately the melting temperature of glass? I have a specific reason for asking that.
Oh, boy. When you properly Google microwave oven experiment or some combination of words like that, you'll find guys that will put a brown beer bottle in a microwave oven with no water. The glass of the brown beer bottle is not a good dummy load. You're near the threshold of damaging the magnetron tube. But these guys will watch the melting. They're looking through the door and they're watching the melting and the explosions and everything else going on. The glass, the amorphous material called glass, as you heat it up, develops a hot spot. The glass becomes lossier at microwave frequencies as it starts melting, and pretty soon you're concentrating all the heat in one spot, and you watch the glass glow in that microwave oven. A dangerous experiment. Don't do this on a microwave oven that you think is expensive and valuable to you. As I said, you're at the threshold of damaging the darn thing, but you start scanning Google articles that you can find on microwave experiments and high voltage experiments, and boy, there's a bunch of nutty guys out there putting all kinds of things in microwave ovens and watching them light up and spark and explode and so on. So glass will, what's going on here is that the magnetron wants to put out, let's say, 1,000 watts of power at 2450 megacycles. If there's no lossy food or water in that microwave oven, the energy it has launched in there bounces back and forth, it's got nowhere to go, and it starts multiplying. You're developing in the microwave oven your standing wave ratio of 1,000 to 1. You think you're putting 1,000 watts into it. the peak envelope power in the hotspots could easily be 10 or 50 kilowatts, and that will melt glass. So that's what I think you're getting at here. As I said, it's a dangerous experiment. Do it with safety glasses on. Do it on a microwave oven that you're willing to sacrifice. W-A-2-R-Y-Y-K-2-R-I-W.
W-2-B-Z.
B-Z recognized. We'll get to you after Joe and John. Go ahead, Joe, R-Y-Y.
Yes, sir, because I actually did that with an incandescent bulb that had a burned out filament that had no filament. I wanted to just do it, you know, what thing would do. I put it in there, sure enough, on high power, it made the entire bulb light up, and after a length of time, a short length of time, the bulb got hot enough where it burned a hole in the top of the glass. It didn't crack it. It burned a hole clean through the top of the gas and light, whatever gas inside thing, I think it's argon or whatever. It must have superheated and, escaped through the hole. But the thing is quite interesting to look at. So my other question here is, if you look at that particular email like I sent you, and I don't know much about the product. I don't know if you've ever heard about that product either, but apparently this stuff turns into some sort of compound where it becomes like a Teflon type of compound and helps seal connectors up to prevent water migration to your connectors and down your cable and so forth. Any comments on that, Dick? I guess you had a chance to look at the email and look at the webpage link.
Yes, I did. And so-called stuff first went on the market 10, 15, 20 years ago. The whole idea of this stuff is that it looks like heavily foamed Teflon beads of some kind. It's a Teflon paste. It's supposed to be a very low dielectric constant material that you're supposed to fill up the type N connector with, the male and the female, and you mate the two together. The stuff is supposed to be so low in dielectric constant that it doesn't affect the RF characteristics of the connector. There's a little bit of doubt in my mind about that. The stuff is supposed to be a very good insulator at RF frequencies. It's supposed to have a very low loss tangent at microwave frequencies, at least VHF and UHF frequencies. But because the stuff is basically a silicon grease Teflon foamed combination, and you're putting that on the mating surfaces of your connector, now those mating surfaces are not making the silver to silver or gold to gold contact they used to make. So you're disturbing the degree of contact resistance of the mating portions of the connector. That bothers me a little bit. The philosophy is you filled up the airspace so it can no longer get water migration. Sounds good, but there's a catch. When you've got air in cable, like say for instance the old-fashioned 9913, and you go from a hot day to a cold day, and that air wants to expand and contract, that air is a power piston. It can create all kinds of force over lots of hours. So even though you've got this stuff in your connector, if your connector is basically a leaky connector where water is capable of getting in, that expanding air in your old-fashioned 9913 is just going to blow that stuff out one end, and then on the next cooling cycle, it's going to suck water back in. So if you compare the stuff solution as opposed to doing a good job of properly sealing your connector using the right brand of cable, and then putting a mile of tape on the outside, whatever, really weatherproofing your connector, I'd have a lot more faith in that than the stuff approach. I didn't say stuff is bad. I just don't have a lot of faith in it. I haven't used it. Now you're hearing some of my philosophy as to why. Let me turn it back to you, Joe, and a bunch of the other people that have heard about this stuff and therefore have an opinion, and I'll turn it over to those people in a minute. W-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, and the Tech Network.
Okay, well, I was asking about it because I really haven't heard of the particular product, and I was starting to wonder. Apparently, they made some measurements of this under some sort of test procedure or test environment, and tested cables with junctions that had either F-connector splices or something like that in them. And at different lengths without this stuff, they observed it had so much loss according to the chart, and they put this stuff in, and apparently it changed the loss significantly. It decreased it significantly. But you're saying that this, you're just better off taping and the connector's weatherproofing property to begin with, and so forth. That's probably what I'm going to do with when I put up something a little more elaborate than what I have right now for TV reception.
Yeah, my interpretation, Joe, of that information you mailed me is that the stuff seemed to be creating suckouts at very specific frequencies, and I think the suckout was like 9 decibels at certain VHF, UHF frequencies. That scares me. and the idea that my mating connectors are not getting gold on gold or silver on silver, that bothers me. And the fact that the power piston effect of real coax cable under real outdoor conditions can blow out any kind of fluid material you've got in there. If you have enough of a leakage in your connector that water infiltration can take place, then I guarantee you, during a hot day, you're going to blow that stuff right out of the connector through that hole. So I don't think stuff is a great solution. It's a partial solution. I'd rather do a better weatherproofing job. But that's my opinion. Maybe other people have used it and fallen in love with it. Another thing that bothers me is the stuff is basically greasy, and as I get it on the connector, even if I do want to wrap tape on the outside, I'm not going to get a good bond of the tape on the connector when there's a layer of grease on the outside of that connector. The tape can't bond anymore. And now I'm not getting as much weather. I'm sacrificing the weatherproofing characteristic of my tape in order to use this stuff. Unless I do it under surgically clean conditions and I got rubber gloves on and I make sure that I don't get any of the stuff on the outside of the connector, it's only on the inside. It's a difficult approach, in my opinion. Not ideal. But maybe other people have got an opinion. If you've got an opinion on stuff, STUFF, the product, give us your call letters right now, K2RIW on the TechNet. Looks like nobody with an opinion. Back to you for a final on this one, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW.
Okay, but when I was looking at it, it seemed like the chart you're talking about, I don't think the stuff was increasing the attenuation. It looked like the chart that they overlaid with the one on top of the other was without it, and with it. With it, it looked like significantly less at those particular joints than without it. That's what I think the chart displayed.
So if you're telling me that squirting stuff in a connector is going to remove the suckouts of the interface characteristic of the connector, wow. If that's what they're saying, and I didn't think that we're saying that, I'm going to have to go back and look at that again. I'm going to have to re-review that. I'm not quite sure what was going on there. But I was seeing 9 dB notches at certain frequencies. And I thought the 9 dB notch was with the stuff present. You thought it was when the stuff was... You thought the native connector had a 9 dB suck out, and you put in the stuff, and the suck out almost disappeared. If that's what they're saying, boy, that's magic. Huh. The stuff has got to have a dielectric constant greater than air. Therefore, any resonance phenomena has to move to a lower frequency. And moving the resonance phenomena of the connector to a lower frequency, I mean, I'm not convinced that that's an improvement. And is it going to correct a Vizwar condition of the connector? See, most connectors, everyone thinks every type N connector has got half a dB of loss, pure hogwash. And everybody thinks the connector... Because it's not, in the case of a UHF connector, if you study it, when it's mated, is something like a 30 ohm impedance internal. And there's a reason for that. 30 ohms is the magic number. Let me drop. When you study the antenna transmission line design data, I think is the name of the book by Ted Theodore, can't think of Theodore's last name right now. It's a 1950 book. Anyhow, he's got some beautiful data in there, which tells you the origin of the ohms and the impedance of our transmission lines. 30 ohms is the magic number where you get maximum power handling. 72 ohms or so is where the transmission line coax cable has minimum insertion loss. 66 ohms is where you have the highest voltage standing characteristic, highest dielectric strength, and 120 ohms is where you get the highest impedance as a cavity resonator. So there's a whole bunch of different impedances you could have chosen for your coax cable. The Europeans have chosen 70 or 75 ohm cable, and we chose 50, which is some kind of a compromise. But a UHF connector, when mated internally, has something like 30 ohms. And people really lose a lot of sleep about the 30 ohms of that connector. Don't lose sleep over it. The darn connector is only 7/8 of an inch long. If I really study on Smith chart or any other kind of program, what happens when I take 50 ohm cable and put a 7/8 inch length in the middle of it that's 30 ohms, and then go back to 50 ohm cable. You study the perturbation that makes, and it's extremely small. You can get away with murder of an impedance bump in a cable if you only do it for a very small fraction of a wavelength. Until you get up to above 432 megacycles, the UHF connector is a beautiful thing. It can easily take multiple kilowatts of power. As ugly and as cheap as that thing is, there are a lot of guys who know how to install that on the end of a cable. It's mechanically rugged. It can take a lot of power. It's got a great big center conductor. It can take the current. Almost all of the connectors we use, as you go to higher and higher power, the first thing that fails